Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Life's greatest wonders can bring some of its biggest challenges. Case in point, premature babies. These tiniest bundles of joy can come with complex mix of medical, emotional, and ethical challenges. 540,000 babies are born preterm every year in this country. New technology and medicines are helping to save lives of preemies, some no larger than a stick of butter. They are cared for by the dedicated doctors in the neonatal intensive care unit. This hour on Point, inside the deeply moving world of the NICU. You can join the conversation. Do you know firsthand of the miracles that happen inside the NICU? Do you know the heartbreak? Joining me now from Chicago is Dr. Christine Gleason, Chief of Neonatology and Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital. We can now add author to the list of her many credentials. Her new book is Almost Home, Stories of Hope and the Human Spirit in the Neonatal ICU. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane.
Well, most people have never been inside a NICU, so help us understand what happens there. What's the role of a neonatal intensive care unit?
Well, neonate, first you have to understand that's a baby less than a month of age. And so most of the babies that are in our neonatal intensive care units are premature babies, but that's not all that happens there. These are babies that need to grow and develop and often are facing, you know, life-threatening problems with their lungs and their intestines. But there are also babies who are unexpectedly sick at full term, and then babies who are born with a variety of birth defects, which thankfully most of the time we know about those ahead of time, thanks to all the prenatal care that a lot of the mothers get these days.
Mm. And 10 to 15% of babies born in the U.S. every year are treated in a NICU. Is that not right?
Right. And there are different levels of neonatal care that they have. Not all of it is sort of intensive care the way we always think about it on respirators and so forth. But yeah, it's about 10%, 10 to 15% of all births will wind up needing some kind of special care before they're ready to go home. Mm.
Walking into a NICU for the first time can be very intimidating. And I should say that my own son spent 3 months in a NICU here in Boston.
He was really
born 3 months early at 27 weeks gestation. He's 3 years old now and he's doing great. But I remember when I was taken in, wheeled in for the first time to the NICU to see him, he was just over 2.5 pounds and it was 4 o'clock in the morning. And I remember being wheeled into the NICU and I saw all those incubators lined up in the room. And I thought they looked like little caskets lined up. And I thought, how in the world could these babies possibly survive? What do you see, doctor, when you look at a NICU baby for the first time from your perspective in the NICU all these years, frail and weak? What do you see?
Well, in my book, which I start with my own career and how I became a neonatologist, and my first impression was the same as yours. I was scared to death when I walked into the NICU. And I still remember that feeling. I mean, I didn't know how to open the incubator, and everybody looked so competent. And then there were all these tiny babies. And, you know, you could hardly see the babies for all the equipment and
That's
things
right.
around them. And everybody seemed to know what they were doing. And I was so clueless. I had to sort of sidle up to a mother who obviously was experienced and knew how to open the portholes on the incubator and sort of see what she did in order to be able to do that myself. So it can be a really frightening place as you experienced. And then it really becomes like your second home, doesn't it,
That's
after
right.
a time? And you get to know all the staff there. And it's part of the reason that I got the title for my book, Almost Home, because it really is. It's like its own culture, its own home away from home, and parents start to take more and more of a role in the care of their babies and lose some of that fright. And I've always remembered that. And as much as we can tour people ahead of time, if you know that a baby is going to require neonatal intensive care, it's just great to have parents have an opportunity to at least see it before they're thrust into it as the parent of a baby in the unit.
you wrote your book, Almost Home. Well, really, in essence, you wrote down your first story from the NICU, what, almost 30 years ago?
Well, it happened 30 years ago, right, and then I wrote it down.
Tell us the story. Introduce us to Jimmy.
Well, Jimmy was the first baby that I took care of as a young intern. This is a pediatric intern. We're a subspecialty of pediatrics. So I was doing my pediatric residency, and I was introduced to him as the senior resident said, well, here's your patient, one of 10 that I inherited from that neonatal ICU. And he hadn't made any progress. He was a very premature baby. But the thing that was most memorable about him, and the reason that I wanted to write his story down so it wouldn't be forgotten, was that his mother was a teenager and in high school, and she had this little tiny baby. He was probably about 25, 26 weeks, which is pretty premature. And again, we're thinking 30 years ago, there wasn't as much we could do for those babies as we can do now. And she had really felt and had been told by her mother and everyone else that she should just, you know, forget about the baby and had planned to give the baby up and so forth. And
For adoption or
something. She hadn't really expected, and I don't think her mother did either, that the baby might survive. And I just sort of took it upon myself to sort of say, well, this baby needs a mother. I mean, he hadn't been named, and there was so much that I was having to do with him and for him, and it just seemed to be causing so much suffering. And I sort of felt, well, I mean, I was such a novice. He's the one I had to learn to open the incubator doors on. And so I reached out and tried to get in touch with the baby's mother, and I did. And she became involved in his care, and it was by phone mostly. And in the end, it didn't go so well for Jimmy. But his mother was able to be there and to be there with him. And I thought, did I do the right thing? You know, did I do her any favors? Did I do him any favors by bringing his mother there? You know, to basically say goodbye to him after all the things that we were doing had in the end failed. And I think I just wanted to tell that story. I think about him so often, and I think about his mother and what happened with her life. And now that I think about it, she'd be in her 40s, you know. Mm-hmm. I wonder what she has thought about all of that. And I hope it was the right thing. I know it was for the baby to have his mother there and his grandmother.
Well, you talk about Karen, this mother, in the context of the story in the book. You think about a newborn baby, and so many people reflect on the first time you hold a newborn. But for premature babies, it's very different. And in the NICU, it's very different. Will you talk about the importance of bonding and the human touch when you have, you know, a bouncing bundle, normal baby? It's different when you have a 2 or 3 pound baby in an incubator.
Yeah, or even a sick full-term baby that needs, you know, has had surgery, and you're sort of thinking, oh my gosh, so fragile, I'm going to hurt the baby. But I often tell the parents, you know, the baby, when you're there and the baby hears your voice and feels your touch, the baby knows right away. That baby knows you from when you were in the womb. And the fathers, too, they know the voices, and that's all good stuff. Where I'm there, or a nursing staff or respiratory therapist, we have to hurt the baby sometimes in order to do what needs to be done.
Putting in an IV, doing whatever. Uh-huh.
So any touch and handling by the baby's family is always good stuff. And actually, we've learned a lot from developing countries. We do something called kangaroo care now, which, believe me, 30 years ago, parents were hardly even allowed to touch their babies.
Well, that's right. And now kangaroo care is you put the baby right on your chest.
Right. And the father's chest, too, skin to skin. And, you know, babies grow better. The sick babies are always in better shape after they've had kangaroo care. And in developing countries, the mother becomes the incubator, and the baby is nursed there on her chest and feeds there.
Well, it's not a stretch to say, Dr. Gleason, that there was a day when, you know, 30 years ago or longer, when you had a premature baby, in a shoebox, fed him with an eyedropper and hoped for the best, right?
Yeah.
Tell us how far medicine and technology has progressed in the treatment of premature babies.
Well, it's just been phenomenal. I mean, and I think that's one of the stories that I really wanted to tell, was to sort of fast forward after 25 or 30 years ago when I was a new trainee to the present day, because there is so much more that we have in our NICUs that can save babies. So many babies who survive now would even 10 years ago would likely not have made it. And of course, we hope that they make it also in better shape, so that their long-term outcomes are better than they were as well. So there's just a tremendous amount. Baby ventilators, babies don't have as much blindness and so forth, all premature babies. Pediatric surgeons can do incredible things to save babies who with birth defects who would have died. But, you know, and so the advances have been phenomenal in neonatal intensive care, and I'm incredibly grateful for that as a neonatologist. It gives me many, many more things to hope for and to give parents hope for. But I would love to be out of business. I would rather not have any premature babies to deal with in our units. And I think that we need to have a lot more advances in understanding what causes prematurity and how to prevent that and how to prevent certain birth defects, if that's possible, and basically put ourselves out of business.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the fast-paced and very moving world of the neonatal intensive care unit. My guest this hour is Dr. Christine Gleason, Chief of Neonatology at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital. Her new book is Almost Home, Stories of Hope and the Human Spirit in the Neonatal ICU. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Gleason, I remember my son's neonatologist telling us that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you could look out on a playground and identify the children who had been premature babies. They were generally smaller. Many of them had eye damage, so they had thick glasses. Not today. As you were saying before the break, the technological advances have come so far, so fast, that you can save so many babies than ever before.
That's right. It's just been amazing when I think about some of the outcomes that we had before. We used to have babies in the neonatal ICU that were there for many, many months, some even a year or two. And that does still happen sometimes because of some really significant problems that some babies have to face. But more and more, we're able to pull them through those first few critical days or weeks, and that gives them a much better chance to not have some of the devastating complications of prematurity that used to occur years ago.
Tell us about the young patient named Patrick in your book. You met him as a preemie. You were a second-year resident. Tell us his story.
Right, and I should say that all the names and a lot of the identifiers of all of these patients, in case people are wondering, have of course been changed.
HIPAA is alive and well. We understand.
Right, right. So, but Patrick was an amazing baby, and this is a baby that as a resident, again, I was a pediatric resident, and we were called to deliveries. In this case, it was unexpected. A woman came in, and a young woman who didn't know she was pregnant, and she had very high blood pressure. We call that now preeclampsia or eclampsia in her case, because she actually had seizures and from her blood pressure, and it was all associated with her being pregnant, but she didn't know that.
And she was 20 years old, a college student.
She was 20 years old, a college student, and the baby had to be taken really to save her life, no matter how premature the baby was. And, of course, she didn't know how far along she was in the pregnancy, but I went to the delivery with the neonatal fellow, who was, you know, certainly a rung above me in training, and this little baby came flying out, and he was incredibly small, less than a pound.
And smallest baby you'd ever seen.
It was by far the smallest baby I'd ever seen. And, you know, back in those days, again, we're talking 25 plus 30 years ago, you know, there wasn't thought to be any hope for babies that tiny. But this baby came out, and unlike a lot of premature babies I'd seen at the time, He was actually moving around. He had his eyes wide open. The babies, they're very premature. They're like a kitten. The eyes are fused, and the skin is very gelatinous, and they're very weak and fragile. And this baby was not. I just remember looking in his eyes, which were open, you could see. And this baby had this incredible will to live. And, you know, we always debate, well, gosh, should you resuscitate? Should you go forward? You know, a tiny baby like that really didn't stand a chance, you know, back in those days. We didn't even have equipment that was small enough to take care of them.
Right.
But this baby just was, you know, saying, I want to be here. And so I looked at the fellow and it was like, well, we didn't have to do anything. So we just took care of him and brought him over to the unit. Everybody was stunned. I still have a picture of him and me, you know, at a month or so when he miraculously survived, never needed to be on a respirator.
He was breathing on his own from the moment of birth.
Yeah. And so he, I hope, has had a wonderful life. And, of course, he probably, these days we call this a growth-restricted baby. He was probably much farther along than Jimmy that I just talked about, maybe even 30, 32 weeks, like the octuplets, you know. But just small, very, very small for his age because of the mother's blood pressure kind of squeezing his placental lifeline. So he just didn't get enough nutrition in utero. So he was very, very small, but he was more mature, and that's probably what made the difference for him.
What are the ethical and moral decisions that doctors like you face, neonatologists like you face, when a baby is so small and so sick, this little guy, Patrick, under a pound? What are the discussions that you have about when is too small to save?
Well, among ourselves, we talk about this all the time. And you know, I didn't write this book to be a soapbox for, you know, this is the way we should view this, here's what you should do or shouldn't do, and so forth. It's a discussion that I hope we have with each and every baby and each and every family. And they're all unique. They're all different. And so it's just terribly hard to be thinking about, well, what is this baby's future going to be like? And how can I make the decision, whether as a physician or a parent? How can a parent make a decision? How much is too much? How far should we go? Mm. So they're incredibly difficult issues. We face them in elder care, too, you know. But I think they're all the more poignant when people think about babies and they think of the possibilities for life and how life can go forward and quality of life. It somehow, at least for me as a neonatologist, we think about these every day and with every patient.
Let me get to some calls, Dr. Gleason. Beth is on the line first from Taos, New Mexico. Beth, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a very emotional and mixed. I have a lot of mixed feelings about this topic for two reasons. I'm 46 now, and I had a brother who died a couple of days after birth at 30 weeks, mm-hmm. just so many years ago, from placenta previa, which now, of course, the odds are that he would certainly have made it.
Right.
And then I myself have a 30-week daughter, ironically, due to placental abruption. She's 4.5 now. And so obviously she was saved. So I'm very grateful to the technology that allowed my daughter to live, which wasn't available when my brother needed it so many years ago.
Does she have complications, mm-hmm. Beth?
Well, she does. And this is where I feel very mixed about it, because although she had a very standard NICU stay, she was there for 47 days, which for a 30-weeker is pretty typical. And she only had one staph infection in her umbilical catheter. That was her only complication.
Mm-hmm.
So things were looking great, but we weren't really adequately educated by the NICU staff, although they were fabulous, about what to expect later.
Mm-hmm.
We had absolutely no idea. And she had we all had a terrible time during her infancy and her early toddlerhood with a lot of sensory issues that we didn't know were sensory issues. She just screamed all the time and was very hard to soothe and ate poorly and slept poorly. As a toddler, she did a lot of self-stimulating and had poor eye contact and didn't want to be held. And we thought maybe she was autistic, although she sort of popped out of all that around age 3 and a half and is doing very well now, although she still has a speech delay.
So these are all issues, and Beth, I hear them, and Dr. Gleason, I hear them from mothers a lot, that the parent education that happens after the fact, after you leave the hospital, that's in many ways, when the hard part really begins.
Yeah. I feel it too, and I hear the suffering from so many families. It goes on and on, you know, even into school problems and teenagers. That what can we expect? I think the really hard thing is that we don't know. We don't have good tests that can actually predict a particular baby's outcome, and it's actually, we have things that can predict the risk for certain things, like the more premature you are, or if there's been a brain hemorrhage or things like that. It increases the risk for certain, especially neurodevelopmental kinds of problems like you were talking about, Beth. But we don't have a way to sort of predict at the outset what things are going to happen to your baby and what your baby is going to turn out like, even when the risks are really high for there to be devastating problems. We see kids come back and they don't have them. So it's something that I wish that the advances that we have in neonatology, in addition to trying to prevent prematurity, also look at ways that we can help parents and identify certain risk factors early on. And of course, the key here is to have good follow-up so that as you go along as parents, you know, having somebody there in addition to your pediatrician who sees premature babies in follow-up, 6 months, 2 years, school age, can really be a help to parents to say, your baby's on track or your baby's
not. Step back a little bit, Dr. Gleason. Step back. What are the causes of premature birth?
Well, we know a lot of associations, but we don't necessarily know the causes, and that's what we really need to find out. There are a lot of mothers who come in and the membranes rupture and she's infected. The womb is infected. We know that that's an association with preterm labor and birth. And then there are other problems that you know, Beth had with placental abruption, where the placenta actually separates from its moorings and the baby has to come out early. But the vast majority of premature births are really unexplained. There's a horrible term that I think is used from the old days with obstetricians, you know, incompetent cervix. I mean, what an awful thing to say to a mother that your cervix is incompetent. And I think we have to change that term. But there are things that are known to be sort of risk factors for preterm birth. But until we really understand them better, we won't know how to prevent it.
Prematurity affects all socioeconomic groups, but there is a significant racial and ethnic disparity. African Americans have the highest rate of premature birth, about 18%, which is well above the national average of 12.8%. Do we know in this instance why those differences occur?
No, but I'm so glad you brought that up, Jane, because the racial disparities in this country are really huge when it comes to prematurity. And as the rate of premature birth has increased, it's increased even more, which it has, you know, in the last couple of decades, our rate of premature birth in the United States has gone up. How could this be? And the rate has gone up disproportionately for African American women. And we don't really understand why. I mean, it's not all about socioeconomic status or poverty and that sort of thing. It really isn't. There are probably other factors that are involved. And of course, it's a global problem, because if there's issues here and there are racial disparities and some of them have to do with prenatal care and poverty, well, then you can imagine what that's like in a developing country.
Oh, that's right.
Where you don't have those kinds of resources.
Let me get to another call, Dr. Gleason, to Charlottesville, Virginia. Ray has been waiting patiently. Ray, thank you for calling.
Hi, Jane, Dr. Gleason.
Hello.
You really can't appreciate this topic unless you've lived it. Back in March of 1981, my daughter was born 8 weeks premature because my wife had developed what they called back then toxemia.
Right.
And with the high blood pressure she was running, they had to take the baby. And I was the first to see her, and the doctor basically placed her in my hand. She was 2 pounds, 11 ounces when she was born.
Yeah.
And the doctor told me she had a 50-50 chance of making it through the night, and then her odds went up exponentially every day after that. And it was just, it's absolutely heartbreaking to see your little tiny baby filled with tubes, stuck with needles, tubes in her mouth. And we would go every 3 days and feed her. My wife had to, we had to rent a breast pump so she could pump some breast milk, and we would feed her an ounce, and they would chart her progress in ounces. And every single day that we went there, we just took it day by day and said she survived another day. And the miracle, people say, oh, she's a miracle baby. No, the miracle is the amount of care and detailed, just the care that the nurses gave my daughter back then. That was a miracle, how much these people cared.
That really is such a big part of the story, Ray. I really appreciate your call. Thank you. Ray brings up an interesting point, Dr. Gleason, about the feeding of babies who are in the NICU. You know, a lot of mothers may want to breastfeed their babies, but they don't have the chance with some of these premature babies especially.
Well, breast milk, though, there's been a huge, that's another one of the, excuse me, one of the greatest advances is our ability to actually take the mother's breast milk, which is unique. A premature baby's mother's breast milk is specially designed for premature babies. I mean, how does the body know that?
There's just a new study out about that, isn't there?
Yeah.
About the importance of breast milk pumped for a premature baby.
And, you know, these tiny little babies that we have, when they start feeding, we're talking about a fifth of a teaspoon. So the mothers are really given a lot of support, lactation consultation, in order to be able to provide, by pumping, just that little bit of breast milk. And the babies that are breastfed can do better in some ways. But we also have great formulas now that are also, the goal is to try to design them so they're as much like mother's breast milk as possible, but have some of the extra nutrients that the babies, now that they're outside of the womb, they're not able to take it all, like calcium, things like that, for their bones and the proteins and things that they need. So the breast milk supplements that we have can actually make the breast milk even better. Or in the case where a mother is just too sick or is just unable to pump milk, these premature formulas have been an incredible advance.
We should really talk about the cost of premature birth, because it is significant, and the cost of NICU care is quite significant. What's the average cost of a baby who stays in the NICU?
Well, it's very expensive. It's thousands of dollars a day, depending on, of course, the level of care that they have. I've seen data that suggests that, you know, somewhere around $26 billion. Well, gosh, that doesn't seem like so much now that we're paying all these banks and stuff with the reserve. But it's a huge amount of money is expended to care for preterm births in the U.S. annually. It's a huge amount of money. And, of course, a baby is sicker or needs a longer time, longer stay in the unit, the costs go up exponentially. So it's very, very expensive. And, again, if you can prevent it, that's the best for everyone.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about saving premature infants this hour, one baby at a time. Real-life stories from the neonatal intensive care unit. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Christine Gleason, Chief of Neonatology and Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital. And I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. With us from White Plains, New York, is Liza Cooper, Director of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit Family Support Program at the March of Dimes. Liza, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Full disclosure here, I have worked with the National March of Dimes organization and currently sit on the board of the Massachusetts chapter here in Boston. So I know a thing or two about what you all do there. But Liza, tell me about the NICU Family Support Program. What does it offer families in crisis?
Sure. What I was touched by that Dr. Gleason said is that she wants NICUs to be put out of business. And we can very much relate to that at the March of Dimes. We're working towards a day when every baby is born healthy. And while we do this, we feel it's essential to be there for families for whom prematurity and birth defects are a reality. And through our national program, March of Dimes NICU Family Support, we bring information and comfort right into the NICU with families so that they can be the best advocates for their children and go home bonded to their babies as confident and competent caregivers.
And so what does that mean, Liza? What are the needs, especially of parents, during this very difficult period in the NICU?
Well, one of the things that you brought up was kangaroo care, and I was so glad that you did. We did a national research study on our program to look at its overall impact, and families told us that the most comforting activity that they can be offered in the NICU is to be able to hold or kangaroo care their baby. And staff also said that this was essential in terms of reducing stress and enhancing bonding in families. But staff told us that only 8% of them routinely perform kangaroo care in their NICUs. Mm. And so we saw it as an area that we need to improve upon and grow in hospitals across the country.
Will you talk about the guilt that new mothers who have babies that are in the NICU feel, especially premature babies, mothers who feel that they must have done something to create this? I remember thinking with my son in the NICU, born at 27 weeks, you know, what did I do to make this happen? I had a perfectly normal pregnancy. I was doing everything right. And I was assured by the doctors that, in fact, I didn't do anything wrong, that sometimes this just happens. But how do you deal with the guilt, Liza, among many of these mothers who feel terrible that they must have caused this?
Absolutely. One of the most important things, I think, is to know how normal that emotion is and to have staff that will ask parents about that feeling and tell them that this is normal and common and find out what they're worried about that they did wrong. Because every parent in there, especially mothers, has something in her head that she thinks made this happen. And another thing I want to share about guilt is very interesting, and I think it's also helpful in relieving that pain that guilt causes, is that when something goes wrong, when something doesn't go the way you expected and dreamed for, like having a perfect birth experience, right, and instead going to the NICU, we feel an incredible loss of control, and guilt sometimes makes you feel that sense of control is restored. You feel, if you did this, if you're responsible for this, you can make sure it will never happen again. And so in that way, guilt is a strange medicine that we give ourselves to try to move through a painful experience that we didn't expect.
I would also say leaving the hospital without your baby is very difficult. When that baby is in the NICU and you go home, tell us how volunteers in the family support program, they're a big part of this. How are they involved with that transition?
Absolutely. I think, and Dr. Gleason brought this up as well, anticipatory guidance. And some of your callers asked about this, letting people know what to expect, whether a volunteer in our NICU family support program or a staff person says to a parent, you know, it's sometimes very hard to go home without your baby. And so you might want to expect that this feeling can come, but you can call this NICU anytime during the night to ask how your baby's doing. And here, we're going to take this beautiful picture of you and your child that you can go home with, and you will have that, and you will see your baby the next day.
I have to say that's one of my great treasures is that little Polaroid that nurse took, Dr. Gleason, at 4 o'clock in the morning. And the calls that you receive from those parents, I remember calling around the clock, getting up at 2 in the morning to make those phone calls to the doctors. How is that baby doing? It's very comforting to have a kind voice on the other end of the line.
Well, we tell parents all the time, you know, one thing that's really good about the NICU is that we really are up all night, so you never have to worry, you know, that you're bothering somebody, you know. The nurses really want to have people calling in and so forth. So I say, you know, you wake up at 3 in the morning and you're there pumping your milk, you know, get on the phone. We put the phone right by the incubator, you know, and try to do things that, you know, try to bring the home to the NICU and the NICU to the home. And I think it really... It helps families, and it actually helps the staff, too, because these almost become partially our babies for a time, and so to be able to be with a foot into the home, I think, is very comforting for our staff.
I have a post on our website from Alexis. She says, the credit of premature babies and their care goes to the nurses in the NICU. She has a 27-week baby and is appreciative of the technology and the care that saved that baby's life, and mostly for the nurses. And I, I guess I would echo that. Let's go to some more calls here in Burlington, Vermont. Jan is on the line first. Jan, welcome.
Thank you, Jane. It's nice to be on the line.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say, first, I agree with everything about the nurses. We're incredible. Our son is now 16, but he was born at 27 weeks because of my preeclampsia. And so he was only a pound 14 when he was born. And I guess what I really wanted to get on to say is that I just wanted to say a word of hope for people going through this now. Because, you know, if I could have seen 1 minute of what my son is now when I was in the NICU, I would have been so reassured. And he's not perfect. He has cerebral palsy. He walks on crutches. But he has also been class president. He's got gobs of friends. He is a wonderful student. He's a wonderful singer. He has lots of talents. And we always say he's the best entertainment we ever made. He is really a wonderful, wonderful kid.
But to see the end from the beginning, Jana, I hear your point, Dr. Gleason.
That's wonderful. That is so wonderful to hear. I think that the families that go through this themselves are really the best people also to mentor the families that are just coming into the NICU, and to be able to hear stories like we just heard from people who are now going through it, and to hear what could be and what they went through even 16 years ago.
That's a very important point. Liza Cooper is part of the NICU family support. I know that's vital.
Absolutely, and I was going to say that's something families have told us, because we constantly learn from families, even as we learn from your callers today, that having someone who's been through that, who's been in your shoes, to say, it's going to be okay, and I can say that because I'm on the other side of those doors. We also have a website, shareyourstory.org, for parents to make just that connection where they can share stories, wisdom, and support with other families who've been through the NICU experience.
It's very therapeutic. Here's another call from Elizabeth. She's in Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Dr. Gleason. I'm so thrilled to hear a conversation like this coming from a physician, for all the reasons that all the other preemie moms you've heard from have said. We rely so much on the nurses, but very often we don't have that same bonding relationship with the doctors, I think. So I guess part of my question, I am, truth and disclosure, Jane, I'm the mother of a daughter born in 1988 who didn't make it. Mm-hmm. And my daughter Emily was the subject of my book, Born Too Soon, and which really sort of tried to look at a family's experience for precisely that reason of, you know, trying to help other families with this. And one question I have, what about long-range follow-up for those, for the non-survivors, for the people who don't make it? We're hearing these wonderful success stories, and they're making me thrilled and happy to hear. And but not everybody makes it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, even the survivors don't always make it. But we know there's a long-range problem with cranial bleeding and other things. But, you know, we basically left the hospital, and Jane, you're right, leaving the hospital every day without a baby was excruciating. But leaving with a death certificate's pretty bad, too. And then, you know, you don't hear anything. It's like you fell off the earth.
So it's the long-range follow-up. I hear it.
You know, we had no education. I mean, I'm happy to tell you that my daughter Emily, who I like to think is a junior in the College of Heaven, has a, you know, has a brother now who's healthy and obnoxious. But we really, you know, it was only through self-education. I mean, there was nothing like every other mother, Jane, you too, we all, you know, wring our hands, what did we do, and will it ever happen again, and so forth and so on. And there's really not much long-range follow-through, and I'm wondering what Dr. Gleason's position is on that.
Elizabeth, thanks.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me tell you how sorry I am for your loss all those many years ago. I'm really sorry. I think different hospitals, different programs do things differently, and I hope that we can do a better job for our grieving parents. Over the years, I've been in a number of different hospital settings, and where I am now in Seattle, we do parent support groups for people who've had losses for a variety of different reasons, particularly at the Children's Hospital, where there are a lot of, you know, not just the NICU, but other reasons that people lose their children. And I think, again, the idea of parents and people who've not only been through it before, but being together with other parents and memorializing in some way their child and the life that their child has led has been very powerful for me. We
an important part of the healing process.
Yeah,
and let me get another call in, Dr. Gleason, because we have so many lined up and just a few minutes left. Beaufort, South Carolina, is where Corey is calling from. Corey, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I had two comments or two questions, actually. The first off of what you guys are just talking about, you know, there's a lot of guilt, and especially with someone that loses a child, a lot of sad feelings afterwards. Has there been much research showing an increase in incidence of postpartum depression, you know, for women and mothers of premature babies?
That's a great question. There has been a lot of study that has had to do with the so-called vulnerable child syndrome, where people are feeling so their child was so sick and fragile and so forth, and so parenting and all the stresses that go with that have really been looked at very carefully. And we know that there are a lot of issues, and parents need a lot of support for each other, their marriages, and so forth. Postpartum depression and whether there's an increased risk for that, I'm not aware of any literature in that. Liza, do you know of any?
I have sort of heard anecdotally that that is probably the case, and that there's just something so vulnerable about that experience for families that it can bring on those symptoms.
Yeah.
But one of the special things about the NICU is that there is so many staff looking in on that parent. And that if we make our staff more aware of the symptoms of postpartum depression, there is really an opportunity to do an intervention when there might not so easily be if a parent goes immediately home.
Here's another call from Providence, Rhode Island. James is on the line. James, welcome. I don't have very much time left, if you could be brief.
No, that's fine. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I found the experience that we had in the University of San Francisco Medical Center was just a very holistic experience regarding how they looked after us as a family and the child, and they after all was said and done, they sent us home earlier than they would have wanted to in order to be home for Christmas. And so it was really very family-oriented. It was more important to be home as a family for Christmas than it was to stay in the safe ICU, and it was just a fantastic crew, and I have a lot of respect for it.
That's great.
Thank you, James. I will turn one question to Liza Cooper. What would you say as far as the NICU Family Support Program to those people who are surrounding a family, mother in crisis with a baby in the NICU? I remember for William, you know, not having a baby shower. People were so uncomfortable. They didn't know if that baby was going to live or die. They didn't want to celebrate prematurely. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you say to people about the uncomfortability of talking about this, about being present for someone who's going through this?
I think really listening. I think being there is not necessarily giving advice or guidance or telling the answers, but instead hearing a parent's experience and story and remembering that they want to be validated and celebrated as parents as well, and helping them connect with that child so that they can be advocates for them and hopefully one day go home with their child and feel attached and loving and caring for them well into the future. I think that makes a difference for that baby who goes home, how that parent has attached to that baby and how the staff has helped make that possible.
I remember 3 years ago on Mother's Day, just a few weeks after our little guy was discharged from the NICU here in Boston, calling his primary care nurses and wishing them a happy Mother's Day because they had cared for him like a mother, really, in those first 3 months of his life. And I wonder, Dr. Gleason, if that's how you feel about your patients. They become like family. That's what I got the sense of in your book.
They do. And you know, we're always so glad when they're going home. But, you know, even when I was writing these stories, even then, I was sad when they were over because I just wanted to, you know, keep going. And I think the pictures, our nurses in the the University of Washington Medical Center, NICU, have really gotten into photography, and I think that that's been great for them. We have pictures of these babies, with their parents' permission, of course, all over the unit, and the parents themselves take this whole chronicle of their child home with them. Mm. So I think pictures are a great way for all of us to remember all these babies and to keep them in our hearts.
Well, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation. Liza Cooper, director of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit Family Support Program at the March of Dimes. I know you're working on an important weekend coming up, March for Babies, 900 communities across the U.S. this weekend. More information about that on our website. Liza, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you, Jane.
And Dr. Christine Gleason, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
The story is Almost Home, Stories of Hope and Human Spirit in the Neonatal ICU. It's a terrific book, Doctor. Thank you. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.